technically, well, it's hard to put it into words exactly, especially when you try to do it for the first time. Obviously, the difference between a living person and a dead person, there is a way of thinking about that where you would say the difference is a chemical one. In one case, metabolism is going on, in the other case, not. I am beginning to think that this narrowing of our conscious focus into three dimensions for survival purposes that I mentioned a few minutes ago may have actually cut us off not only from where the game will be next month or who stole the chicken, but it also may have cut us off from contact with the after-death world, because it has no efficacy in the very nitty-gritty blood and muscle problem of day-to-day survival. And that what we have discovered in DMT is literally a chemical doorway to the bardo. And that this, I think, is an even more confounding notion than the notion that we are being pheromonally managed by Zeta Reticulans or something like that. I mean, after all, if that were the case, it would probably just be one of many programs of social manipulation that are administered by some hideous bureaucracy somewhere beyond Agol, and there's careerism and blunders and budget overruns, and in other words, it sort of comes back down into that's what the problem I have with all extraterrestrial scenarios is. The extraterrestrials seem so much like ourselves. I think probably it's that we have found the pharmacological key to the bardo, and that this is going to overturn civilization so completely that we might as well just call an end to it and recess the meeting. And if you ask shamans about this, you say, you know, what is this all about? They will tell you, well, we do all our work through ancestor magic. Well, ancestor is a very sanitized term, because not too many people, when they hear the word ancestor, realize that we're talking dead people here. So when a shaman tells you he works with the ancestors, he's saying he works with dead people. Well, if that's the case, then we are close to being able to secure, in a rational sense, the answer to one of the questions that has driven us most buggy throughout history, which is there continuity of something after the body dissolves? And I am the last person to ever carry this message into society. I was raised Catholic. I rejected it. At age 14, Jean-Paul Sartre, Jean Genet, Friedrich Nietzsche, these were my gods. And I felt, you know, that moral responsibility, existential honesty, demands that we put aside the cheerful fairy tales of more naive levels of culture, and that anybody who wants to talk to you about the dear departed and all that is, you know, in the grip of menopausal mysticism or something, or just hasn't carried out a rational analysis of what gives. Now, I think, you know, these religions have all made hay out of, and hash, I might add, out of their imagined franchise of the after-death world, because they use it to beat you on the head with some moral laundry list of do's and don'ts that's very dear to them. And it can be anything as nuts as that you shouldn't eat pork to who knows what, you know. On all sides of the world and has only been thrown into question by the scientific high-tech democracies in the last 500 years or so, and for them only among a secular educated elite, the premise that is that there is something that persists beyond life. And I think that part of the profligate irresponsibility of modern life arises from the fact that we don't think we have dues to pay. We think there's an easy way out, and that you can be a jerk and then just become food for worms and nobody will ever get on your case about it. And so moral relativism has come into play. But if in fact we are securing in some form the notion that the human personality or some portion of it persists after death, and that there is an ecology of souls, and that we must in some sense share this planet with them, because after all, when you smoke DMT, you don't go anywhere physically. You simply see your nearby environment from a different dimension through different eyes. Then it means that we represent a tiny minority of the human beings who care about this planet. We, the living, are just a tiny slice of who cares and who is active in the situation. And somehow we are being, through chance, which I don't believe in, or through design, which seems everywhere around us, we are being brought up short and told that in order for the Earth to survive, we must join everyone else in this other place. And that it is not to be conceived of as dissolution, it is to be conceived of as disembodied. This is the only thing I can figure out that is going on. There is some kind of project underway to transfer the lumpen living into the realm of the grateful dead, and the anxiety that we feel about death is an anxiety born essentially of ignorance. And this ignorance is understandable because we have suppressed, repressed, and denied shamanism the leadership role that it should have in metaphysics of all sorts. And so now, we're about to become extinct. And you can like it or you can not like it. You can decry it as the greatest tragedy ever to befall us or this planet, although I suspect the planet will heave an enormous sigh of relief. But there is a perspective in which it can actually be seen as progress, that we are all at once going to transit into this bardo realm. Now, this may not be it may not be a simple die-off. It may be that somehow a dialogue can be set up with these souls or their representatives or whatever they are in this other place, and that a world can be established which is neither quite theirs nor quite ours. In other words, that the difference between being alive and being dead, which seems to us fairly fundamental, could in fact turn out to be fairly minor and erasable, or the boundary could be moved from where it is to somewhere else. This stuff is hackle-raising in its weirdness, but if you're going to be true to the content of the experience, then I think you're pushed in these kinds of directions. And the a tractor at the end of history that seems to be pulling the human world, certainly, if not all of space and time, into its domain, is in the act of realizing itself, going to obliterate the kind of distinctions that we have grown used to, even on such fundamental issues as life and death. That's the grandest conception that I've been able to come up with, and it doesn't require friendly, altruistic, extraterrestrial flying in from Betelgeuse, and it doesn't involve nanotechnological downloading of everybody into a gold ytterbium cube buried on the back side of the moon. And it doesn't involve the human enterprise simply becoming a layer in shale somewhere in the strata of the paleontological record of life on this planet. It is, you know, a fitting denouement for the mess that we have wandered into. It does require unlimbering of the imagination to come to terms with this, because we are in great denial over the possibility that the world could really be transforming itself. I mean, about as far as most of us can go without getting metaphysically uncomfortable is to embrace recycling and population control. But I doubt that such cheerful diddling with the machinery will be able to swerve us from our path. I think, like it or not, we are going into a world that we literally, as we sit here, cannot conceive of. A world so different from ordinary reality that to discuss whether we will be alive or dead in that world is mere quibbling.
There's one point I wanted to clarify real quick. I didn't see this launching of the alien psychedelic spore templates as a bureaucratic enterprise. I almost always envisioned it as a real provisional underground thing, maybe done by a small minority of shamans in a you know, desperate hope to somehow, you know, propagate their origins.
You mean alien shaman?
Yeah.
It could be that. I think I sense a crisis in the physics of the matrix itself. In other words, I think that this is not only happening to human beings. I'm serious when I say, you know, there's only 20 years of history left and we still have half of it to do. We're going to have to do some pretty fast stepping. I mean, what we took 50,000 years to do, we must now do in 20 years. I think that space and time and the physical body and the planet and that everything is essentially some kind of an illusion. It's not real. What is real, what is truly bedrock, and I guess this comes close to being a Buddhist position, this is all provisional. This is not what the universe is. The universe is something else. You know, the Buddhists have a doctrine that if a single person will attain enlightenment, then the illusion will collapse instantly. All beings will be sucked into the post-enlightenment state. And the illusion of space and time, of becoming an entity, will all be obviated at the snap of a finger. Well, we tend to disbelieve this because no matter how metaphysical we are, we may even call ourselves Buddhists, we really believe that Andromeda is 250,000 light years away. I mean, we can't conceive of a light year, but we actually believe that what the scientists tell us. And yet, my God, when you start when you start carrying all out a critique of modern science, you cannot believe what fluff this stuff is built on. I heard an analogy recently which I thought was very interesting. Our entire picture of the so-called distant universe is built up by the science of radio telescopy, the use of radio telescopes to study deep space. This science has been in existence since about 1950. If you were to take all the radio signals that have been analyzed by radio astronomy since 1950 and characterize them as energy, it would be the amount of energy that is released by a cigarette ash falling a distance of 2 feet. So this is the thinness of the data out of which we have created these incredibly grandiose conceptions of what is happening. Science is just whistling past the graveyard. Don't forget that the telescope is about 500 years old this year. So to believe, you know, that the story science tells us is true, when we can't understand the mathematics, we cannot build the instruments ourselves, we cannot analyze the data. I mean, we are under the thumb of a priesthood more domineering, more removed from the ordinary concerns of ordinary people than any priesthood of any religion in the past ever was. I think we should hold all that in abeyance. I'm not saying it's not true. I'm saying it's not possible to tell whether it's true or not. One thing psychedelics will do for you, for sure, is to convince you that what's real is what I call the felt presence of immediate experience. That's what's real, you know, what you think, what you feel, what you see now is what's real. Even your own memories are so shifting and elusive and subject to psychological transformation based on your own inner and unconscious dynamics and kinks, that to believe what somebody else is telling you about the temperature of Betelgeuse or something like that, or the charge of the top quark, means you've moved off into some kind of private Idaho. Crazy people rave about stuff like this. But I think people who are rooted in a good philosophical method will not give much credence to anything out of reach of their good right arm. And the psychedelic experience is an experience. No, I didn't present you with a set of tensor equations or a tape of electromagnetic data interpreted through the fiat of a fishy formula. We're talking experience here. And this experience, if made commensurate with ordinary experience, I think leads to the conclusion that this is, I said this the other night, this is as dead as you'll ever be. This is as low as you can go. This is as confined a mode of existence as it's possible to know. And it's all up from here, folks. It's a kind of Gnostic vision. It sees our present circumstance as the low rung of a ladder of transformational distillation. And, you know, we come from we know not where. I mean, we have, yes, the details on the fertilization of the egg by the sperm and so forth and so on, but where the form comes from, we don't know. This is the mystery of morphogenesis. And then where the form goes to, we do not know. I mean, I now think that the proper way to think about biology is biological objects plants, animals, fungi, bacteria, amoebas, and human beings. Biological objects are hyperdimensional objects. You can tell that that's true because whenever you... What is the sine qua non of a biological object? Meaning, what is the thing it must have to be biological? It must metabolize. That's the essence of life. The form is stable, but the matter and the energy which compose the form are in constant cycling. The form stabilizes, but the energy is flowing through it, which stabilizes it. Well, when we use phrases like cycling through it, flowing through it, these are words which imply a temporal dimension. If you have a chair and you cut into it, it doesn't bleed, it doesn't squirm away, it doesn't begin to rot and fall over. If you cut into a living object, it undergoes all kinds of changes. This is because you have destroyed one of the dimensions necessary for its manifestation, the temporal dimension. The living body has a relationship to time which the chair doesn't have. The chair is borne along in the stream of time. The biological object is made of time itself as much as it's made of space and matter. And so, really what birth is the descent of this mysterious entity called the form into matter. It clothes itself with matter and energy through a process of gestation, unfoldment, separation from the environment of gestation and unfoldment, which is the mother's body. And then it has an autonomous existence. But what is generally true of all life in the phylogenetic, in the ontogenetic expression, what's true is that it has finite duration. Everything dies. The individual dinosaur, the individual elephant, the individual human being, they die. That means that the form eventually withdraws itself from the domain of matter and energy, and it then presumably exists as it existed before, having added whatever adumbrations three-dimensional experience has given to it. So I've come to see the body as basically the placenta of the soul. And, you know, that's a way of thinking about it that makes dying not so terrifying. I mean, it's as terrifying as smoking DMT, but it's nothing to claw the walls about. The body is the placenta of the soul for the individual. Well, then it's just a short step to realizing that we are now called upon as a species to abandon the body. The body is the collective body is the collective placenta of the species, and you don't do a war dance around the placenta. Once it served its function, which is to bring the forming fetus to the point where it can exist and sustain itself in the dimension for which it is destined, in the case of ordinary birth, that's three-dimensional space and time. In the case of this metaphor, it's the hyperspace beyond space and time. Once we are ready to exist in that dimension, it's time to undergo the journey down the birth canal and bury the placenta under the old apple tree and forget it and move on. And, you know, I grant you, the analogy isn't perfect. I mean, where is the midwife? Where is the waiting bassinet? But perhaps the answer to that is the midwife is waiting in these intimations of the friendly alien presence. It may be an aspect of humanness that awaits us just over the great divide. And so we are going to have to, I think that probably now at every talk I give, I make the analogy to birth. That this is what we in the 20th century are experiencing. The 20th century is analogous to the birth canal of human history. And so, you know, the wonderful swim in the amniotic ocean is over. The fool's paradise of the fetal life is ending. Now, the walls are literally closing in. We can't get enough oxygen. We're using up our food. The walls are strangling us. There's no room on this planet for all of us. And for us, it's a catastrophe. But I imagine when a woman goes into transition, that the fetus, if it's not a metaphysician, must be fairly alarmed by the situation. He must just say, well, I guess this is it. It's all over. I'm going to be strangled, suffocated, and simultaneously choked to death in this situation. It would take a far-seeing fetus indeed to embrace the journey down the birth canal as the road toward, a split-level ranch house in the hills above Malibu if you play your cards right. Surely that gets the idea across. Yeah.
Could you say more about your content of your experience? I was really fascinated. And it seemed like there were some qualities to it that I wanted to know, hear more about.
Well, sure. DMT, if you take it orally, is destroyed by enzymes in your gut, so it has to be smoked unless you have a chemical strategy for inactivating those enzymes. So, assuming you smoke it, it comes on in about 30 seconds, and if you're a leather-lunged hashashin, you can maybe get it in one swell foop. But it takes most people about 3 hits. And the first thing you notice is that it's as though all the air has been drawn out of the room you're in. Suddenly the colors come forward and the edges sharpen. This is really happening. It has an extraordinary effect at low doses on visual acuity. So does psilocybin. And then you close your eyes. You feel very peculiar. A kind of anesthesia sweeps through your body, a kind of numbing and yet a sense of a building bubble of energy. You close your eyes, and after a few seconds you see forming in front of you what I call the chrysanthemum. It's a floral mandala, usually in yellow and orange, most people say. And it's slowly turning. It's like a wall, but it's a hallucination. But it's right here, right in front of you. And you watch it for about 15 seconds. If it stabilizes, you need one more hit. But what usually happens is that after about 15 seconds of contemplating this thing, it's as though suddenly whatever was holding you back, the cable is cut, and you are just propelled through this membrane, and you hear a sound like a bread wrapper being crumpled, a cellophane bread wrapper being crumpled and thrown away, or the crackling of flame. This is, according to a friend of mine, your radio entelechy exiting the anterior fontanelle at the top of your head. But he could be wrong. But whatever it is. And then you hear a tone. which is, it could be reproduced on a synthesizer. It's that, you know, and but it keeps going and becomes hypersonic, supersonic, subsonic, I don't know. There is a sense of, literally, a membrane is ruptured, and now you're there. And what happens to me is, the first thing I hear is a cheer, a yell of greeting. It's on their second album, the Pink Floyd have a song in which they sing, the gnomes have a new way to say hooray. Well, you break into this gnome nest, and it's a very specifically characterized place. It is domed, it's indirectly lit, not brightly lit, but it's soffitted lighting of some sort. It's comfortable, but all of that is hard to focus on and relatively inconsequential, because the main thing that's happening is these things come bounding towards you like greyhounds. And there are many of them. These jeweled, self-dribbling, transforming basketballs, which look like iridescent electric radiolaria or something. I mean, they are diatomaceous neon transforms made of syntax or some damn thing like that. And they come toward you, and you have to deal with yourself in this situation, because most people, in my reaction, is absolute amazement, complete hysterical disbelief. I mean, you just say, you know, my God, what is happening? It comes so quickly that it isn't like a drug where, you know, you deep breathe and you close your eyes and you wait for an hour and you slowly summon it out of its crevice. It's not like that. It's like you were struck by lightning. In fact, some people think they have been struck by lightning, that they never got to the drug, that just as they raised it to their lips, they were struck by lightning, or a jet fighter fell out of the sky, or something. And then you have to ask yourself, is this okay? Because it's so radical and it happens so quickly and your eyes are wide open and you don't see anything recognizable. Three-dimensional space, the room you were in, everything, it's gone. Instead, this place, and then they tell you, they try to reassure you, although they're not very reassuring. What they say is, don't give way to amazement. Don't abandon yourself to wonder. Basically, don't be a jerk and a rube, you know. Pay attention. Pay attention to what is happening. And then they proceed to do a very intense form of teen teaching. They come bounding up, they present themselves, they also do this weird thing where they jump into your chest, and then they jump back out. So you're having this sucking in and out of your body thing. They jump in and out of your chest, and they are singing and squeaking and squealing in some kind of elf glossolalia, which you can see. This is very important. They speak a language which you look at, you don't hear. And they make objects which are like super puns of some sort, in that the object is not one thing. It is somehow several things simultaneously. The way a pun attains its effect by being simultaneously more than one thing. But these are not verbal puns. These are objectified puns in three-dimensional space, and they're funny. And the whole thing is pervaded by the word zany is what I use. It's a form of humor, it's a form of merriment, but you can't entirely relax around it because you can't entirely be sure that you're getting the joke. So it's like, it's a humor with an edge to it. And they are showing you these jeweled, I've compared them to Fabergé eggs, and when they show you these things, you can tell by looking at them that if you could bring a single one of these objects, no larger than an orange, into this world, it would end the debate. I mean, all you would have to do is show it to somebody, and they would say, that's impossible, but yet it's happening, so therefore my reality is dissolving. I mean, it's somehow to gaze upon these objects is to be forever corrupted for ordinary consciousness. Make them with their voices. These objects are quasi-alive. The objects themselves can sing and make other objects. So you're just being, you're like in this, a cross between Santa's workshop, Tiffany's, and the basement of the Metropolitan Museum, and they're offering you all this time. I've somehow stretched the thread too tightly, and now I'm never going to make my way back. And they're saying, no, no, can that, that's not what's happening, this is what's happening, pay attention, look, look, look. And then it just fades very suddenly, and they sense it coming. They have urgency because they know the window is tremendously narrow. And in the final moments, in some cases I recall, they literally, it recedes away, or you pull away from it, and they say, déjà vu. And then you open your eyes and you're in the room you left. It's like 1,000 mics of LSD or something. You are more loaded than you have ever been in your life, and you immediately proclaim, my God, I'm completely down. And, you know, the walls are rubbery, the Persian carpet is crawling around, your friends have faceted faces and look like they just climbed out of one of Billy Meyer's starships, but you're absolutely completely down, you accept this as ordinary, it's all you can do to keep from kissing the good earth, because where you were was so much removed from that, that there is no comparison. Well, now after doing this a number of times, because the first time you do it, the goal is pretty much to live through it. I mean, it's like being shot out of I think it was Tim Leary's metaphor. He said it's like being shot out of a cannon with Baroque barreling, and afterwards people want you to draw the barreling, when what you were trying to do was live through the experience. But after you do it many, many times, 10, 15, it depends on how bright you are and how able to resist freaking out you are, my impression became, and this is astonishing to me based on what I've said so far, this is someone very strange. It's someone's idea of a reassuring environment for a human being. This place you end up, which is the weirdest place you could ever conceive of or imagine, has been specifically designed by someone to be as mundane, ordinary, and like this world as they could possibly make it. Not only that, the impression that I have is the vibe of this place, if you will, is it's a nursery. It's a playpen, in fact. And these toys, these things, these elves, are nothing more than the equivalent of stringing a string of colored plastic objects over a bassinet. They're to teach you spatial relationships and hand-eye coordination. You are briefly in a nursery for receiving human beings who have just crossed over from hyperspace. Well, imagine if all you knew about this world was a nursery and a maternity ward or a home somewhere, and you were trying to deduce the nature of the universe from a 30-second visit to a human nursery. That's the kind of position we're in. And I think that is what gave me the notion that this has to do with the after-death state. Apparently, one, the soul is literally being born into this other dimension, and the soul is not, it's exactly like this world. When you're born into this world, you're just a little worm of a thing, you know? You have to be held by your mother, you have to be swaddled, you have to be kept away from bright lights, breezes, men with cigars, and so forth. And the soul, as it transits into that place, you immediately meet the extended existence of your soul in an entirely new domain. Yeah. You mean stayed in that place? No. And it seems to me unlikely that anyone would, because interesting about DMT is that it has, it occurs naturally in the human brain. We all make it all the time. And so in a sense, this is not a drug at all. This is a human metabolite that you're getting a tremendous overdose of. But the fact that it occurs naturally in the human brain means that you have chemical pathways, biosynthetic pathways, that can deal with it. That's why it lasts so short a time. One way of talking about the toxicity of a drug is to ask the question, how long before you feel perfectly normal after taking this drug? If you have a drug that 24 or 48 hours after you take it, you still have lower back pain and you're lying in warm baths and avoiding ringing telephones and don't want to talk to anybody, that's a toxic drug. I don't care whether it's coke, methadone, or LSD, you shouldn't. That's not good. DMT, if 10 minutes, within 10 to 15 minutes after taking it, you not only are down, you can't tell you did it. There's no residuum, no lingering headache, no dryness of mouth, no dilated pupil, nothing. It's like you took an ice cube and hurled it into a blast furnace, and then you went looking for it 15 minutes later. It's not to be found. It ain't there. Well, this is amazing, because this is the strongest psychedelic there is. You'd think that you'd have to put ice packs on your head for a week after this experience, and instead it's completely gone. So Rupert and I, in talking about this, he developed the idea of what he called a necrotic compound. He thinks that DMT, that at death, you flood your system with DMT, that this is what these pathways exist for, and that it sets you up for dying, and that if you can, and I gave DMT once to a Tibetan Lama, who, a very old one, not one of these alcoholic fundraising Lamas, but the real thing. And guy took it like a man. He was probably 92. And afterwards he said, it's the lesser light. He said, if you go further, you can't return. That's the limit. Beyond that, there is no fail-safe. And he was perfectly matter-of-fact about it, and I took him at his word. I mean, if anybody should have known, this was the dude. And I think it's a tremendous argument for hope. And you see, it's not only an argument for hope, it means that if we could get the... well, the infantile, shit-brained, drug-phobic yahoos sent back to wherever it is that they are going to be sent to practice their family values, then we could actually do significant research and find out what's going on here. It's an object of legitimate research. We don't have to genuflect in front of this like it's a religious mystery and will always be unknowable. In principle, what we need to do is you explore this dimension the way you explore any unknown dimension. You send people of great courage and descriptive skill in with their notebooks, their telescopes, their tape recorders, or whatever is the equivalent for this job, and then you find out what it is. And I think that the destiny of the species may be spun into this. It may be that this transition into hyperspace is not as inevitable as I previously assured you. It may be that we have to do something on this side. We have to meet them halfway through the mountain. They're boring toward us. We have to alert ourselves to the fact that a tunnel is possible and then get cracking, you know, with dynamite, which is an amalgam for DMT. Yeah?
Terrence, can you go into briefly say something about the distinction now between what you have spoke about the last 10 minutes with the distinction between the Fabergé eggs and basketballs and self-transforming machine elves, and that one may occur by going into the Amazon canopy and experiencing some type of preparation prepared by the natives. Is that organically mixed, earthly-based hide similar to the synthesized DMT? Now, I have taken DMT many years ago, but it would seem that the natives may describe it, at least, in a much different fashion than yourself. What is the distinction? And then also, if you can hit on, after that, the distinction between that and psilocybin.
Well, the difference is not as great as maybe your question implies. First of all, the thing that is so interesting about DMT is if the only requirement is that you be able to hold the toke, and if you cough and lose it, then it's murky and mucked up. In the case of ayahuasca, which is what you're asking about, I'll explain to the group. Remember how I said that DMT is destroyed in your gut, so you have to smoke it. But then I added the caveat that unless you somehow inactivate this enzyme system in your gut, which will destroy it, the DMT. Well, it turns out there's a way to do that. The enzyme system is called monoamine oxidase, and there are compounds called monoamine oxidase inhibitors. If you take a monoamine oxidase or MAO inhibitor, then, and follow it with oral DMT, then the DMT will not be destroyed in your gut. It will actually be absorbed into the lining of the small intestine, a large intestine, and then passed into the bloodstream, and you will have a psychedelic intoxication. Well, in the Amazon, this has been understood by the shamans for a long, long time. And so they take two plants. One, Banisteriopsis cuppi, a large woody vine, a twining liana, and it actually contains a powerful short-acting monoamine oxidase inhibitor. And they take this vine and they pulverize it, and they combine it in a large pot of water with the leaves of another plant which contains DMT. It may be one of several plants. It's usually Psychotria viridis. Then they boil these two things together, and then for hours, and then they pour the water off and save it in a jug, and put fresh water on this mess of two different plants, and boil it again for hours. And then they pour the two water fractions together, and they get rid of all the solid matter. They throw it away. It's now been cooked for 6 to 8 hours. And they take this watery fraction, several gallons, and they drive it down over a hot fire until they get something, a dark brown, thick liquid that is truly horrifying to ingest, because the taste is so ghastly, because all the salts and sugars and God knows what else have been concentrated into this stuff. But this is now a beverage, a liquid. I love it that in the literature they call it a psychoactive beverage. And when you drink it, the compound from the woody vine, harmine, inhibits the MAO, and the DMT passes through and enters the bloodstream. And instead of a 10-minute experience that reaches the apex of intensity in 2 minutes, you get an experience which is drawn out, stretched out, over about 4 to 6 hours. Now, usually, this is not, it's a psychedelic experience. It's similar to mushrooms in some ways. But if you really make it stiff, if you really put the pedal to the metal on the amount of Psychotria viridis, or DMT-containing leaf, that you put into this stuff, then after about 2 hours, you can slowly, by sitting in darkness, by practicing breath control, you can slowly manipulate it into a place where you then say, you know, by gosh and be golly, we've made it to the elf nest. Here it is. So I think that great shamans, courageous shamans, have always been able to make their way into the presence of this thing. But I put the great qualifier in front of the word shamans, because in my actual field experience in the Amazon, what I discovered was, once it got you loaded enough to be comparable to, say, 4 grams of mushrooms, most of these guys would look at you in horror if you suggested that it was only twice as strong as it should be. There, the shamans all over the world have an ambivalent attitude toward these dimensions they go into. Very few just hurl themselves delightedly into complete boundary dissolution. I had a guy tell me once, he said, you think just because we run around wearing penis sheaths that this stuff is easy for us to do? Well, I've got news for you. It's as hard for us as it is for anybody. It's hard for human beings to surrender to something so strange. I could never get ayahuasca to carry me into the DMT nest until I made it myself. And then, with nobody, you know, holding my elbow and keeping me, telling me how much Psychotria viridis I should put in, I was able to jack it up and jack it up until finally it was truly horrifyingly strong. And that's what you want. I mean, we're not interested in colored lights and dancing mice here. So, now let me see. Did I cover the waterfront? No. Comparison to DMT, to psilocybin.
So, Simon, in that, you explained one time in one of the past lectures that the earthy or UFO-type images that appear from the psilocybin as opposed to more earthly mother-goddess connection of the ayahuasca.
But I think if you push the ayahuasca hard, it all begins to migrate in this direction. Psilocybin, you know, I advocate 5 dried grams in silent darkness. 8 dried grams in silent darkness will give you the indistinguishable from a DMT flash. The problem is, you know, one thing about DMT that is both frustrating and liberating is that it's so brief. Basically, it's like a roller coaster. The great consolation is this is only going to last 5 minutes. If you climbed on a roller coaster of super intensity and as they dropped the bar over your lap, they said, oh yeah, this is the 4-hour trip, then you would say, well, you know, hold on.
It does appear, though, that by IV, which is mostly how I did it years ago, that it seemed that it was extended to about 30 to 40
IV DMT?
Yeah.
Do you mean that you shot it intravenously? You don't mean that it was a perfusion pump situation?
No.
No. Well, see, I've talked to people who've done research on DMT, and a surprising conclusion that comes out of those discussions is that shooting it is not as intense as smoking it. Shooting it... Well, yeah, it sounds fairly intense, but people who do both say shooting it can't lay a candle to. And this is a funny thing, I'll just mention it as an aside. Drug researchers love to shoot drugs into their experimental subjects. They love the syringe as the route of administration because you get better numerical data because you can measure the dose absolutely, and then you hit them, and you know they got it. If you smoke something, you may, you know, obviously when you can hold your breath no longer and you exhale, smoke comes into the room. That's not part of your dose. And sometimes there's a residuum in the bottom of the pipe. That's not part of your dose. So in the name of precision, people who've done research on DMT have always shot it. Even the recent study out at the University of New Mexico, it was by injection. I tried to persuade them to do a section with smoking, but this argument for numerical precision carried the day. But the effect of relying on intravenous injection like that is that no one in the clinical situation has ever observed or experienced the flash that I'm talking about. I don't think you can attain it except by smoking.
Now, how about the penis snuffs?
No, I've done those, and that is, tell the truth, let the chips fall where they may. Highly overrated, for several reasons. First of all, you have to snuff close to a tablespoon of these toasted and powdered Anadenanthera peregrina seeds, and there's a lot of cellulose there, and so you do not absorb it instantly. The other thing is it's so physically unpleasant to do it that there's a tendency to cut low on the dose, because when the standard method of administering edema is you have a hollow reed, like a bamboo reed about this long, you fill it with this powdered, toasted sawdust, essentially, that has been reduced to flour. And you get up on your haunches, and your friend comes over, and you put the tube up your nostril, and he blows. He takes a huge lung full of air, and he just blows as hard as he can. Well, the effect is like being hit in the face with a 2x4. I mean, you stagger backwards, you salivate, it's intensely painful, you scream, you squirm around in the dirt, and then you get back up on your haunches, and by that time he has loaded the tube for the second nostril. And then the whole thing happens all over again, except now you're salivating, your eye is swollen up, your sinuses are filled with this gunk, and you do it again, same thing, scream, squirm in the dirt, so forth and so on. Then you stagger over out of the sun into the shade and sit with his saliva just pouring out of your mouth, and after about 5 minutes, you begin to drift into a psychedelic state of some sort. But there is no sense of a rush, of a splitting of the world into two halves. It's not an effective route of administration.
Well, how about what do you call the Kora spirits?
Oh, well, once they get intoxicated, then they play this strange game, which is almost characteristic of this white Yanomamo cultural group. Guys square off. They stand about 3 feet apart from each other, and by some means, the equivalent of tossing a coin, it's been decided who will go first. So the guy who goes first is totally loaded on this stuff, and he has mucus running out of his nose, saliva running out of his mouth, his eyes are swollen, practically swollen shut. He pulls back his hand, and he hits the other guy right in the center of the chest as hard as he can. So the guy either loses his feet or doesn't. Anyway, he grunts like a bull and stands there. He also is in the same state. Then he pulls back, and then he does it. And they keep doing this until somebody is knocked off their spot. And when you interview them later about this, what you're told is your ability to stand on your spot depends on how many of these Hikuli spirits you have inside your chest. And so this is some kind of Yanomamo psychology meeting the raw data of the DMT experience. I don't know what they're talking about, but it has something to do with the DMT things that jump in and out of your chest when you smoke it. They believe that they say the demon from the tree will live in your chest. And the more of these tree demons inside your chest you have, the more physically able to resist being knocked off your spot you are, and the more shamanically empowered you are. But this goes to a point I often make with my groups, which is, you know, one ethnic group or one culture's drug is another person's pain in the neck. You know, I mean, I've taken awful drug that the people, after it was over with, they would, you'd say, you know, God, you guys do this all the time, it's really kind of and they say, yeah, well, it takes getting used to, and we really don't do it all that often, only ceremonies. And you're right, most people are glad to get it over with and go back to the palm beer.
So your experience is basically that it's too caveman-like, it's very hard on the system biologically, and it makes it so that the time that you could be having in exploring these strange dimensions is somehow inhibited.
Yeah, I don't think in the Ibina taking situation that you ever get enough all at once to the synapses in sufficient concentration to deliver you over into what I'm describing occurring on
the... ayahuasca, and then did the stuff right after you drank the ayahuasca.
Strangely enough, though, those cultural groups do not overlap. You know, where there is ayahuasca, there is never Ipina. Where there is Ipina, if there is ayahuasca, there never comes.
There's no ethnography done right now on that. That may be an area where someone wants to explore by bringing in non-indigenous sources of ayahuasca into the Yanomamo area.
Well, people are, you know, traditional people are surprisingly conservative. I mean, I've sat with ayahuascaros and done their brew and talked to them about DMT, and then they say, well, describe it. And so then I will describe it as I described it to you here. And then my best guy said, well, no, it sounds a little intense. I think I'll take a pass on it. You know, and he was my mentor in the domain of ayahuasca. It's pretty stout stuff. I think that, you know, shamans have always, you know, looked over the fence, looked through the keyhole, stepped through the doorway. But I think DMT, pure crystalline DMT, or ayahuasca specifically brewed to reality obliterating doses, is the only way you can approach this place. Yeah.
I'm wondering, on the experience you talk about, you're being taught.
You mentioned that, yes.
Yeah, the second part would be, how have you done it?
I've done it maybe 30 times. I haven't done it for a couple of years.
DMT or
DMT? Sometimes I think it's a young man's game, or sometimes I'm just getting chicken shit, you know. This is not a drug of abuse, let me tell you. I know people who say it's their favorite drug, and you say, well, when was the last time you did it? And they say 1968. And they're still processing to feel no need to go back and have a second look. What was the first part of your question?
What kind of knowledge?
The knowledge. The knowledge is interesting. The knowledge is they want me to make language that you can see. They absolutely are convinced that this ability to make things visible with sound can be taught. And that's what they want you to do. They demonstrate it. They say, see what we're doing? See what we're doing? Now do it! And you say, but, and say, no excuses, we don't have a lot of time, it's almost over. Do it. Do it. And then you attempt to do it, and you discover in that place you can do this. But why this is so important? Because when you come back to this world and listen to tape recordings of yourself doing it, it's gibberish of some sort. It's a kind of neurologically driven glossolalia. It's like, it's a language unhinged from the necessity of meaning. And yet, it is true that when you do it in that place, it's absolutely ecstatic. It's like sex, but sex is sort of like a white light kind of thing. This is like a colored spectrum. If you could put the sexual experience through a prism and change the purity of orgasm into a spectrum of stuff, then it would be like this language. It's pure poetry. It's poetry so thick you can literally cut it with a knife. And they want you to do this. And they are absolutely passionate about this is what we are here to teach you, how to speak in a language that can be seen. And, you know, a language which could be seen would be a kind of telepathy. You know, if you could see what I mean, you would see my thoughts. The way we communicate, small mouth noises, and the assumption of shared dictionary, an assumption which is never borne out by careful questioning, is a miserable way to communicate. If we could see our linguistic intentionality, it would be the equivalent of seeing our minds. And so this is what they want us to do. Now, maybe if one were truly dead, they wouldn't be so urgent about it. And they would be like a relative leaning over a bassinet and holding up objects and saying, "Look at this, baby. Look at this. This is a bell," or something. But definitely what they teach is in the domain of language. And it's not a teaching which can be said, like love one another, or, you know, if it's juicy, eat it over the sink. It's more an ability locked in your physiological structure that we're not using. They want us to speak in colored lights. And it's their agenda, it's not mine. I haven't the faintest idea why that is so compelling to them. Well, that's a little unfair, because I've given a lot of thought to it. But initially, I couldn't figure it out. We'll, I'm sure, get more into this afternoon. It is the little self-transforming elf machine informs me. Lunchtime. Thank you for putting up with this. I appreciate your silent scorn, or whatever it is.